Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champions. Today in our virtual studios, we've got two guests. We've got Kirsty Chadwick and we've got John Dickinson, both from TTRO, a fascinating organization. Welcome, John. Welcome, Kirsty. I'm going to ask you first to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and in your professional life. Kirsty, let's start off with you.
Thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be on your webinar series. Thank you for the invitation. My name's Kirsty Chadwick. I'm the founder and the CEO for the Training Room Online, or TTRO, as we're more commonly known. Originally from New Zealand, grew up, went to university, studied at Teachers College there, taught for a little while, and then sort of started this whirlwind global tour, which I didn't realize I was going to be on until it all sort of unfolded. So I moved to the UK, I taught for a while, started my first couple of companies there when teaching didn't work out. After about 6 years in London, moved to South Africa and established a call center where I was using that call center to really sort of outsource a lot of the services that we're providing to my UK companies. That was in 2005. And then, you know, really sort of felt, I guess, the pain of what education in South Africa and largely across the continent of Africa was going through, with large volumes of students, you know, not having equal access to good quality education. And that was really what prompted me to start looking at how technology could be used as an enabler in the teaching and learning process. So, yeah, that was the start of what was the Training Room Online in 2008. And yeah, I guess we're going to explore a little bit of that journey through the recording today.
That's great. Very much looking forward to it. And it certainly sounds like your whirlwind affair with education and learning has taken you to the Middle East as well. We'll talk about that some more. John, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, name's John Dickinson. I'm the managing director for TTRO based in the UAE. I started my career in mobile technologies and later went into consultancy work. Came to the UAE just under 13 years ago, where I worked for various different outsourcing consultancies, but also set up a business which operated in the aggregation of content and distribution of technology, predominantly to support either teaching and learning or marketing industries, focused around ideas like augmented reality, virtual reality, and 3D technology. And then had the good fortune to meet Kirsty and some of the team on one of their trips over here, and joined the guys 2 years ago to try and continue that growth in this part of the world.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Kirsty, I'm going to go back to you for a little bit and kind of take you some time back in time. When TTRO started, even before it started, what was your vision for the organization? What did you see it becoming? And did you even think about markets as the Middle East and others? Or was it very much a local opportunity that you've seen and responded to?
At the beginning, it was very much sort of a local or perhaps an African opportunity that we responded to. And it really was in just seeing the large numbers of people that needed access to a better quality education than what they were getting at the time. And, you know, when I looked at it from a physical instructor-led training model, be that for what was happening in the education sector, all the way through from early childhood development, K-12, into your colleges and universities, that academic space, you know, there was a big disconnect between what you could afford and what you got in terms of the quality of education. So education wasn't accessible to everybody at the same level of quality. And similarly into the workplace and in the world of work, you know, we were looking at large numbers, so big organizations with tens of thousands of employees who were trying to deliver learning. And at the time when we started out, if I look at the financial services sector, the regulatory environment around which they were operating was requiring them to have more mandatory training, and delivering that to 40, 50,000 people and having them trained on an annual basis to not use technology as an enabler became a really difficult thing for them to manage from an instructor-led point of view. So I think, yeah, we really saw it as being responding both with public and private sector, large-scale opportunities to use technology and get a more equal access of good quality learning to more people. So that was when we started out. And, you know, really, I guess at the time, we even explored relatively early on, you know, looking at how could we sort of localize some of our solutions into sort of neighboring countries like Botswana or Namibia. We did some research and we spent even a little bit of time in those regions. But yeah, didn't at that outset have this vision that TTRO would grow to have the potential to be a global organization. And certainly nowhere in my framework until I got the invitation was I seeing us operating in Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
Now, you've raised something really, really interesting here. And I find that in speaking to entrepreneurs, business owners, or executives, when we talk about the kind of problems that we're trying to solve, there's often this notion that we stumble upon an opportunity. We find a problem that no one has solved well or not well enough, or that we feel that we can solve better. And as we do that, we find more problems to solve. We find related problems. We find this whole nesting of problems that or challenges that could be overcome. So if I had to ask you, the original, I guess, challenge that you've described of people not having access to quality education, has that changed, morphed, evolved over this period of time as TTRO has grown as an organization and in terms of capability?
I think it's got the problems actually got bigger, if anything. And a lot of that has been the pace of which skills have needed to change. So the fourth industrial revolution and everything that's brought has meant that what people need to know and when they need to know it and how often they need to change what they know has just become exponentially fast-paced. So I think it's unprecedented the fact that today we sit with skills that maybe are relevant in most careers probably for somewhere between 1.5 to 3 years before the skills actually become redundant and some or other form of technology has come in where the skill set required to do certain roles or functions looks different. So it's not only become about accessibility to good quality education, it's adding on to that is accessibility to good quality and relevant education. And I think that's what the world is largely struggling with it at the moment. It's come beyond being a South African problem where, you know, how do you keep the curriculum of what children learn in school, relevant to then what they go into in college and varsity that is actually by the time they finish that journey going to track them into economic opportunity and jobs that are still current and relevant. So certainly the role that technology plays in bridging that gap and being able to even guide the process. So having personalization and learning, using technologies like artificial intelligence, you know, to be able to make sure that we can support and guide a learning journey and a learning experience where that relevance is mapped into it. So I think it's just kind of getting bigger and bigger all the time. And I think there is no doubt, and COVID-19, if anything, has just accelerated this everywhere in the world, that the future of learning is going to be a digital future. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to need classrooms, that we're not going to need some sort of instructor-led intervention. We definitely do need that. And it's how we construct the blend and how we get the different modes of delivering learning being maximized to deliver that in the most efficient way.
Something else that I've also heard as you were describing this is, would it be fair to say that the problem is also becoming more visible to us, that we're more conscious of the loss of relevance of some of our skills that we've acquired in the past?
Very much so. I think, and we're seeing it in multiple sectors. So it's not something that is specific to one particular industry or one particular sector. You know, the technology is pervasive across all sectors. So the disruption in the skills and the disruption in what people need to remain relevant in those industries, it's everywhere. And I think, yeah, it's kind of hit quite quickly as well. And some of the work that we've done together, Sa, you know, where we're looking at, you know, organizations are doing big transformation strategies, and they need to be doing that. But what is the impact when it drops into the human capital, and how do they make sure that they've got talent that is ready to execute on that strategy and deliver on that? And not just within their current workforce, but also a pipeline of talent that's coming through from the academic system or sector that is delivering them the kinds of youth that they are wanting to employ with the relevant skills that they want to see them have.
John, let me turn to you for a moment and bring you into the conversation. When we speak about these challenges that our customers are trying to solve, what have you seen operating in the Middle East? What are the kind of challenges that they are articulating, and how are they seeing the shifts that are taking place as a result of the pandemic?
I think I'd echo what Kirsty is saying, in that I think when you look at the skill sets that are coming out of schools and universities versus what industry is demanding its employees to have, there seems to be a widening of that gap, unfortunately. And so therefore, I'm seeing increasing numbers of clients that are actually having to train new employees, graduates through their graduate programs, on what they consider to be, or what industry considers to be, core skills that the academic sector should be providing. And then further on down the line, there's been huge investments in a number of industries in this part of the world with regards to digital transformations. But again, what we're seeing is some organizations really keen to engage on what the impact of the technology on the people is going to be, and what the impact of the people on the technology will be, and other organizations not so keen. Other organizations more worried about launching a digital transformation strategy, engaging with external consultants on that digital transformation strategy, but haven't really thought about the true impact on their employees and their potential future employees. And I think that's where we're going to see some organizations really accelerating growth and accelerating in taking market share, significant market share. And other organizations spend a lot of money on technology but actually get the implementation wrong. And I think that's something that we're starting to see coming through now. And I think the other thing about this part of the world in particular, which I think can be said for a number of other regions as well, but is particularly prevalent here, is I think we've got governments in this region that are incredibly ambitious, have accelerated huge change within their countries and cities, and a young population in a number of these countries that are incredibly hungry for knowledge and very ambitious, mirroring their governments as well. And so kind of you knit all of that together, and it means that it's a very exciting time, but a time that organizations need to really consider technology and people together, because the rewards potentially are very, very large, but the risks are also there for all to see.
Very much. Now, you've raised a very, very interesting point here. In the old days when I studied economics, we used to refer to the demographic dividend of countries that had large young populations. And very often that was tied to their role as consumers. What you've just described are young populations which are not just hungry to consume, they're hungry to produce, they're hungry to transform, to change their environments, whether through digital means or otherwise. Is that something that you're seeing in the region as well? Are young people engaging in both producing and consuming?
I think so. I think what you have in the if you say the GCC as a starting point, for example, is you have a number of relatively young countries. And when I say relatively young, I mean in their current state. The kind of where these cities like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, for example, were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago to where they are now, they're relatively young in that kind of evolution, but they've achieved an awful lot. And there's a generation of people that have seen that And don't view this as the end of the journey. They view this as the end of the beginning. And so as a result of that, those ambitions are retained through the next generation of young people coming through. And naturally then, the thirst for knowledge and the desire to contribute to the growth and prosperity of a city or a country is very, very evident.
If I had to perhaps pose the next question to both of you, what have you seen in the attitudes of the young generation that has been joining the workforce in the last couple of years in terms of their attitudes towards learning and taking into cognizance that they have witnessed firsthand very significant shift, John, like you've just described just now. What have you seen in terms of their attitudes towards learning?
I think if I can start on that, I think the kind of what we would consider, if you like, in my world or in our world, in our generation, as to what learning looks like from a school or university to what young people today consider learning to be as two very different things. And I think the availability of information has changed that drastically. And therefore has led to a thirst for knowledge. Unfortunately, not all the information is accurate, good, relevant. And so there is work to do, I think, in terms of developing the skill set to critically analyze sources of information that I don't think necessarily is done fantastically at the moment within the younger generations, but it is there. And the prevalence of information and how that can relate then into knowledge and how that knowledge can then be applied has meant that what you have is a group of youngsters that are coming through in these cities, in these countries, who are used to learning. And it's not necessarily just about skill sets to support a job or a career. It can also be in terms of personal development. It can be in terms of health and well-being. It can be in any number of different fields that make them better people, that allow them to contribute to society in a more effective or more efficient way, but also obviously can enhance their careers. I think that's kind of what I'm seeing at the moment, is that the whole psychology about what learning looks like and is has changed in this generation.
Kirsty, from your side, are you seeing anything different looking at other regions that you often frequent and travel to?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting in Saudi. Saudi Arabia's got a very young population. And obviously with the, you know, transformation that is happening, Vision 2030, there's a real requirement for the youth to engage and be the drivers towards that transformation. And I think we've seen a real hunger for learning and for being able to acquire those relevant skills, both with the men and with the women, and being able to provide their contribution and bring their contribution towards that vision. And I think, you know, we've worked in Saudi Arabia since 2015 when I first went there, and really seen over the last 5 years a quite a significant increase in the number of young people that are really sort of taking on more senior positions, that, you know, are improving and gaining more knowledge and skill as they, you know, sort of track into, you know, very promising careers. So I've certainly seen that lift there, and a real hunger to learn, not only academically and, you know, sort of through the university system, which is incredibly strong, but also then into supported graduate programs and into corporate opportunities. So we've seen a big uplift there, which is really encouraging. So yeah, I think the youth are key to the future success of most countries, and it's so important that we can really equip them well through their formative years in schooling. And I think there's such a lot of work that we need to do and form these public-private partnerships where government and industry aligns, and, you know, make sure that we're equipping through the K-12 system and even into the college and university We're making sure that that alignment of what these skills are is properly understood, you know, that we can move away from very antiquated curriculum, you know, that really hasn't shifted beyond the first industrial revolution, if we're very honest with ourselves. And, you know, how do we make sure that we are able to have agility in curriculum change and in curriculum design? Because if the lifespan of skills is as short as what I indicated earlier on, you know, so too is the lifespan of curriculum downstream in a young person's development and education got to have the same level of agility in that as well.
Now, one of the things we spoke about just at the beginning of this podcast or just beforehand was this whole concept of immersive learning. So I just want to do a little bit of a deep dive. You know, as we hear both the consumers of education and learning are changing, the environments in which they operate are changing, learning in itself is changing. So talk to us, Kirsty, a little bit about what immersive learning is and why is it important?
Immersive learning is where we leverage technologies such as augmented reality and virtual reality, interactive 360 videos. We create simulations with that. So it's immersing the learner in the learning or in the experience of which they're going to go through. So taking it out of the textbook, taking it out of what might have been a video demonstrating that, taking it out of what it might have been, you know, quite a flat, even an animation. It doesn't give one the feeling that I'm in the experience and this is actually happening to me. And in that moment, it can elicit different types of reactions and responses. So if we were to think about virtual reality, when I've got my headset on, I'm immersed in a scenario. If in the instance of health and safety, a fire breaks out, in a virtual reality experience, you can actually feel that and you can test and see the way people would respond, which is very different to the way people respond when they're not immersed in it. So I think it has an enormous amount of application in technical training, in particular training around health and safety. You know, when you're wanting people to be able to demonstrate particular behaviors when in a specific situation or scenario, then it's an amazing way to be able to display that. Augmented reality, when you've got the application on your phone and you're using that to bring something to life or to be able to move around a particular part, you know, it allows the ability to experience real, almost real life scenarios without them being in real life. And I think importantly to that, and John will pick up and talk more specifically to it, but it's that we use that in the right moments of learning. So we use it for creating that transformative learning experience. We're not using it because we can and it's fun and it's kind of the latest buzzword in learning. It's got a very specific application for it to be impactful.
John, from your side, what do you see in terms of the application of and the potential for immersive learning?
Well, I think that the first thing to kind of point out is when we're talking about immersing ourselves in an environment or in an experience, whether that be through some very sophisticated augmented reality experiences or virtual reality or using 3D projectors and or simulators or whatever the case may be, we're actually based on the science significantly enhancing the opportunity to teach people, because the human brain doesn't operate in two dimensions. The human brain sees things in three dimensions and therefore has the ability to learn quicker in three dimensions, and naturally will recall experiences much more efficiently if it is done in that way. And there's plenty of white papers that have been written on that sort of stuff previously. And the evidence is there from teachers that use this technology. The important thing is when introducing technologies like this and content like this to either youngsters or to the world of work, is to make sure that it is planned and embedded in a way that the media that is being used and the content that is being used is consistent. By that, what I mean is, for example, it might be that there is a component of the learning that is done in three dimensions in a classroom environment, for example. But then when those people go away from the classroom environment, they don't have the access to the headset to look at things in 3D. So it's important to consider when creating the content that content is viewable in a virtual reality headset, but it is also then accessible and viewable, for example, in two dimensions on a screen, so that the reinforcement and the consistency of the messaging remains there. It's also important to consider that the delivery is built around the principles around how people learn. So this isn't a gimmick. This is, and the truth is, if you introduce something new, you will typically get a higher level of engagement. But that engagement that curve will drop off incredibly quickly if you don't adhere to those same principles around how youngsters or how people learn, and therefore what the best way to teach them is. So it's about making sure that you're introducing the technology, introducing the experience at the right time with consistent media, and building in learning plans so you know what you're going to use, when you're going to use it, how you're going to use it. And obviously, we do quite a lot of work around that in terms of the curation of curriculum and the building of relevant content to that curriculum and how it can be used and how different, for example, different instructors will choose to use things in different ways. And it's really important that when you're looking at building that library of content, that you know where it can be used, how it can be used, and what the best method of delivery for that content is going to be.
Listening to this, one of the areas that I've certainly seen firsthand in our work together is, and I think both of you allude to it, is the value of design and the value of thinking up front of what the experience would be, not just a technical solution of how we deliver learning, but looking at the learner, in many cases for the first time, as a customer who has an experience, and doing it by design and thoughtful process up front could make a very significant difference. So I'm hearing that as well in the way you're describing it. I think we've moved away from the world where the technical solution was completely divorced from the human experience.
Yeah, and I think that is only going to become more increased as we look at what the metrics of success look like for an organization or an institution, how that information is tracked as more institutions through their digital transformation projects, whether they be schools, universities, government institutions, or the corporate sector, are actually looking at real data to understand the value of employees to the organization. And so the whole thing kind of comes together in one ecosystem. So that the learning and development departments have a responsibility not just to make people better or teachers, instructors to make people better, but also to be able to demonstrate that those people are better as well. And vice versa. So for employees or for students to be able to have portfolios and bodies of evidence to say, I know this, but not just that I know it, that I can actually support other people learning this, and that I can demonstrate in a work environment, I can demonstrate those skills in use on the shop floor or in a practical example, for depending on what the case might be.
John, if I had to ask you, what do you see as the implications for learning and development organizations and for the people who lead them? Because it sounds like the future for them might be quite different to what their traditional role has been in organizations.
Yeah, I think one of the phrases that I hate to hear is that the role of a teacher is changing, which I do when I'm talking to schools, universities, or many different organizations. It's a consistent message I hear, but very few people can tell me what the role of a teacher is changing into. It just seems to be kind of a buzzword in the industry at the moment. I think the reality is, it's like you alluded to, the what we're moving towards is a model whereby you have subject matter experts who aren't necessarily teachers, but then you have instructors who are responsible for supporting the delivery and distribution of learning through the resources that might well be available. So whether that be e-learning, whether that be augmented reality and virtual reality, whether that be through video, different simulations, whatever the case may be, you're going to have this kind of segmentation of skill sets within the academic industry. You're going to have almost three different roles. You're going to have people who understand the subject, people who are responsible for delivery of that subject, and people who are going to validate that the delivery method adheres to the principles associated with the psychology and science of learning to mean that it's got the best chance of success.
I'm really glad you've unpacked that for us a little bit, because changing roles is one of the telltale signals that the industry is in a significant transition or in some cases being disrupted. Yeah. That's often where people feel it the most. Their day jobs change, the requirements of their job change, their progression through the organization changes. You know, the way in which the organization views their performance, their success changes. And that's often alludes to there's a better business model to deliver, in this case, learning.
And I think what we're talking about is, I mean, I'm talking about my perception from the organizations and institutions that I go and visit and I spend time with, and where I see the gaps and the potential industry going and what I see as a potential solution to that. But the reality is, I think the other side of that is that I'm not going out and seeing anybody that's actually nailed it down and got it right yet. Or got it perfect yet, and that's because it is in a state of change. So you know, it's always interesting to hear other people's ideas, feedback, perceptions, and what I'm talking about in terms of that model for a lot of organisations is going to be a significant change in behaviour and culture. And so you know, it might well be that there's several steps that we need to make along that journey to get the right people with the right skill sets delivering the right component at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. Kirsty, I want to bring you back into the discussion here, because that alludes also to a different and an evolving role which TTRO plays with client organizations. So if I had to kind of ask you to project yourself, say, 5 years into the future and give us a description, a glimpse of, if you were to walk into TTRO 5 years from now, what would you be doing or involved in that will give you a sense that the organization has fulfilled its purpose, that has evolved and responded well to these changing conditions?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're seeing into the future and what we've seen in the different locations that we have set up. So from starting in South Africa in 2008, 2015, 16 in Saudi Arabia and in the UAE, 2018 in the UK, and most recently, you know, looking to establish ourselves in New Zealand. I think what it is understanding the core components from an advisory level, from a learning content and curriculum design level, from the learning technology level, and how you manage the services that fit within that framework. It's how do you lift, shift, and localize that? So I think the local content and the localization of what we do and the way that we do it is where our greatest value will be to support countries that are looking to have that transformational change, both from a government side and also from a private sector side. So I think where we've sort of really been able to refine ourselves towards is being able to create frameworks and methodologies, approaches, technologies, and the components that support that transformation of how learning experiences are delivered. And, you know, what I'd like to see for our organization going into that sort of future and you know, where we're being accelerated into now is that we've got the ability to support that in more places and to create local opportunities for job creation and for really defining that at a local level in country. So I think we're evolving nicely with that model. And for us to achieve that, partnerships are critically important. So having strong collaboration and strong partnerships to support our growth and support the growth of our partners together is really becoming quite a key part of our model. And yeah, I think we're evolving and checking on that journey quite nicely. We've learned many significant lessons along the way, and we'll continue to learn lessons along the way. But yeah, we're grateful, and I think it talks, and I'd like to acknowledge the partnership that we have with Ascend Growth. I think, you know, we've been on a journey. We've started our first customer. We've had a very successful engagement. We know what works and what doesn't, and we see the potential for how we can share that experience with other customers in other parts of the world.
I appreciate it. And Kirsty, just a question I always love to ask all of the people who join our podcast series. Greatest success, and often there's more than one, right? It's the entrepreneurial journey has got its highs and lows. What would you describe as one of the greatest successes that you've experienced on this journey, giving birth to this organization, giving it life, and then seeing it grow in such an impressive manner?
I think you sometimes get so, as the entrepreneur, you know, you're so entrenched in everything within the organization every day, for long hours every day. I think it is really sometimes important to stop and reflect on success, because often everybody else sees that, and you generally are so bogged down and focusing and worrying about what's not going right to not lift yourself up to look at what has been successful. I think if I reflect on that, I think it's been really great to have been able to create opportunities for people in the organization as we've grown. I think we've been able to open up opportunities as we've moved into the Middle East for people to go and experience working for TTRO, but working for TTRO in different places. And I think that's something that, you know, I feel, you know, proud of being able to, you know, create those opportunities for people and grow and give people opportunities to grow with us. So it's an important part of our culture. I think, you know, we've done and executed on some really incredible projects throughout that period, which, you know, has created great success for the customers that we serve and allowed them to fulfill on things that they've been wanting to do and be part of that journey and supporting that. So I think that's great. And I think, you know, reflecting back that we do have operations now in four different countries, about to be five. I'm proud to have achieved that. I wish I know all of what I know now when I started out, but I guess that's part of the entrepreneurial journey.
Well, absolutely. There may sometimes be very good reason as to why we don't get that book or that memo up front, right? John, maybe from your side, as you look at other organizations setting up in the Gulf States, having strong, authentic intentions to succeed and to bring value into the Middle East, what and having been there now for, I understand, 12 or 13 years, what are some of the lessons you want to share with them? What are the kind of things that you would want to tell them that may be helpful for them as they start to navigate a new region?
Look, I think there's a couple of things. I think by engaging with or gaining the support of people who have operated in this part of the world historically is only going to add value. There are certain nuances to doing business in this part of the world. There are certain things that it's just helpful to be aware of in the early days. And I think that kind of getting that kind of local representation or local support in some form is important. But the other thing is, I think, you know, do the due diligence, make sure that it's right, make sure that the kind of the finances stack up and all that sort of stuff. But if all of that looks good, then be bold. The governments in this part of the world are very bold. They've published plans for either 2025 or 2030 or whenever the case may be, that are hugely ambitious. And they, in my experience, the residents, the citizens, and the governments in these places will encourage people to come and help deliver on those ambitious plans. So be bold and trust in your convictions. If you know what you're doing is going to be good, is going to be right, is going to add value, is going to support, like I say, citizens, residents, governments in this part of the world, then trust yourself.
I really like how you phrased it, and being bold, and I've seen this in many environments, how that just changes the paradigm. Suddenly a lot of things that we don't want to venture into, think about, commit to, suddenly become possible. They're on the table. You can deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And isn't this just the classic example? I was going to say perfect example. I don't think it's perfect in the world we live in today, in any situation. But isn't this the classic example of what COVID-19 has presented is an opportunity for people to take a step back and rethink what they're doing and how they're doing it, and potentially open up some hugely significant opportunities around that.
Certainly. Kirsty, last words, any lessons from your side to entrepreneurs, wherever they are in the world, any lessons you want to share with them? Could be greatest experience, worst day, or just something that you've learned as we all come out of this pandemic or learn to navigate a fairly uncertain environment, in many cases new.
I think I'd emphasize what John said about the strength of talking to others and the power of networks. Very fortunate to be an Endeavour entrepreneur, business partner, and our managing director, Dominic, is part of the YPO network. We're part of the Invest Africa network. And I feel that these networks, and particularly when times are difficult, if you're part of a strong network, you're never alone. And I think as an entrepreneur, it's very easy, particularly when things aren't going so well, which often feels like more often than not, things aren't going well. Knowing that you've got a network where you can have honest conversations, you can be supported by others who almost certainly will have experienced it, often in far worse circumstances than what you're experiencing it, and will be able to guide and navigate and coach and talk and just be there to help you through it. So I think that power of network and that power of, you know, trusted people and advisors that you can have around you really sets you up well. And never be afraid to use that network when you're feeling at your most vulnerable. I think that is the time when you get the most value and can lift you up from some of the darker times that you have, and which every entrepreneur has. I don't think there's any entrepreneur that I've ever met who's able to say to you that it's easy. Starting up a business is easy, and you will never experience any challenge along that journey. I think that would be the best advice. It certainly served me well. I'm hugely grateful to the network, to the business associates that I have around me that are genuinely there to see us succeed, that want us to succeed, and will go out of their way to ensure they can make a connection, they can point you in the direction, and just be there for you. And I think that when you get those people around you, it makes your ability to be successful that much greater.
Fantastic. Wise words. Thank you both. Thank you for a wonderfully rich conversation. Thank you for bringing to our audiences a lot of insight into the world of learning, how it's changing, and how more broadly we add value to organizations around the world. I have no doubt that your DNA, what made and makes TTRO so distinct, is gonna fare well for you in the future as you grow and expand into new regions. And to our audiences, thank you for making the time. I hope this was as valuable, as insightful as we found the conversation. You can follow us now on a number of platforms, including Spotify, as well as the latest updates and news through LinkedIn. Thanks again, and be well.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.